Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day, everyone.
It is the 14th of December and this is episode 90. Mm. Big time.
The nervous 90s.
Nervous 90s.
Don't throw it away now.
We could get cancelled at any time, but probably not. But we got a huge show for you guys coming up. We are going to be talking to Linda Kavuka from the African Students for Liberty, all the way from Nairobi, Kenya. We're going to be talking about the growing free market movement in Africa and other nations can do to help Africa increase its economic growth. And we are also going to be talking to IPA Research Fellow Matthew Lesh about his big new report, the Free Speech on Campus Audit 2018. It's a big show, but one thing before we start, I need a promise from you, Pete.
Uh-oh.
You are not going to storm out of a podcast again. Pull that on me again.
I got carried away.
You got carried
caught
away.
Caught up in the moment. Nina egged me on, to be honest.
Nina got very carried away. She didn't even turn up this week.
Yeah,
so,
no, I haven't seen her all week.
Saul sitting in for Nina on the buttons. How are we feeling, Saul?
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, Nina's on the hot seat, to be honest.
Yeah, Nina's taking industrial action.
There is absolutely no way that Nina is going to listen to this, so we could say anything. But anyway, let's get into it. So let us talk about this free speech on campus audit. So we are going to be talking about it with the author later in the show. But it is a pretty big thing, Pete.
Yeah, that's right. So as you saw in Hey, What Did I Miss Yesterday, 35 of the 42 universities in this country have policies and actions that are hostile or a threat to freedom of speech. Some universities, and this is my favourite part of the report, actually ban sarcasm. There's a few of those. And we won't talk too much about it because we do talk about it with Matthew later.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the front page of the Oz. There was a whole lot of, what's the word?
Bad
discussion.
Things. Oh, discussion. Yes, a lot of coverage.
In the press, Glyn Davis, the Vice Chancellor of Melbourne Uni, had a crack at Matthew, said he was cherry-picking data.
Yes.
Which is a bit rough.
Mm, absolutely. Well, Matthew replies later in the show, so something for you guys to listen out for.
Check it out.
Yeah, so the total hostility score for all institutions, which measures the number of policies and actions that limit freedom of speech, has increased by 82% between 2016 and 2018, so things are getting worse. And that 35 number of universities that Pete mentioned before that have a red rated for policies and actions, that's an increase from 33 in 2016 and 34 in 2017. So yeah, later in the show, going to be talking about why it's getting worse and how things can get better. But shout out to the University of New England, the only university that Matthew said is green for good freedom of speech.
Where is that?
That is in New South Wales, I think. So wherever you are out there in the big blue world, University of New England, well done.
UNE.
Okay. Thank you.
UNE. Cool. I'll move on to another story. So this one is coming out today. Well, it's come out over this week, but it's really ramping up. The federal government is going to set up a National Integrity Commission to crack down on corruption. Good thing.
It
sounds like a good thing. No one's pro-corruption. Well, probably people are pro-corruption, but no one that we need to be listening to is pro-corruption.
No one admits it.
No one admits it. But this is one of those things that the government's going to get around and they're going to say, oh, we're cracking down on corruption, and everyone's going to be, yay, yay, we're cracking down on corruption. And then suddenly we're left with this giant institution and bureaucracy that doesn't really need any of the safeguards of right of privacy, as we saw with New South Wales ICAC, and things are going to fall apart.
That's right. And Bill Shorten has already called for this commission to have its scope widened. So it's now that it's there, or now that, you know, in the future it'll be there, there's the opportunity for it to become bigger and bigger, like all bureaucracies do.
Absolutely. So the law enforcement division that this is a part of will have jurisdiction over agencies such as the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission, the Australian Federal Police, Department of Home Affairs, and a bunch of others. So it's a big fish. And if you do want to read more about that, so Morgan Begg wrote a media release about it the day that it was announced. He wrote an op-ed. I get all confused. Morgan's had a big week.
Morgan had a big day yesterday.
Morgan had a huge day. So Morgan has an op-ed in The Australian that came out today. You can read that on our website, ipa.org.au. And the cracking opening line, if I may quote it. The only way to ensure vested interest in the federal government doesn't misuse their power is to ensure the federal government doesn't wield so much power in the first place. Brilliant.
Well, it's about time that guy pulled his finger out. So, good stuff.
Yeah, and he also mentions how, Bill Shorten's already calling it for it to be expanded. It's because no politician wants to be seen as being pro-corruption. So, anytime this commission puts its hand up for more regulation, there will be some politician out there who's like, this will be a good PR move for me to say, this should be even bigger, we need to stamp out even more corruption.
That's true, and no one wants to criticise it lest they fall into the crosshairs.
Yeah, you don't look good if you criticise a corruption commission.
Mm.
What are you hiding?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's...
What are you hiding?
Well, I...
Don't. Mate, I don't want to know.
Podcast isn't long enough. But anyway, Pete, let's move on to another story.
Yeah, religious freedom. So as we said, Morgan had a big day yesterday. Religious freedom rules or new laws have been announced by the Prime Minister.
We should mention why it is Morgan Begg. So he's in charge of our legal rights project. That's why it's such a big day for Morgan Begg. I was wondering, just like last man up. But
yeah. I was wondering what that guy was doing here, but that is correct. That's what he does here at the Institute of Public Affairs. The Prime Minister yesterday announced that we knew religious freedom protections, anti-discrimination laws, be introduced before the next election. So it doesn't actually say what the laws were. It just says we will announce more laws in the future, including, of course, a commissioner at the Australian Human Rights Commission for Religious Discrimination. We'll get Morgan to talk about this in here to talk about this in due course. He did sort of justify these laws on the basis that would assist multicultural communities because multicultural communities are more religious than the rest. So that's a new kind of way of selling it. As Morgan wrote in his media release yesterday, you can't solve the problem of anti-discrimination laws by passing more anti-discrimination laws. The only way to protect religious freedom is to remove laws that currently place restrictions on religious thought and practice.
Yeah, absolutely. If there's anything worse for freedom of speech, it is like bringing in someone whose job it is to police what speech is permissible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way to do it.
Yep, exactly. And there's another, you know, like there's already a Human Rights Commission this is in their purview.
Yeah.
So another figure... Mm-hmm. is not necessarily something we'd be for.
Yeah, it's just a case of like that old principle of if you give the government the power to do something for you, you're also going to give it the power to do something against you just by the same law. So the second you have like a religious freedom commissioner, you've got to imagine at one point there's going to be someone like, you know, maybe this wouldn't happen, maybe this is hypothetical, but maybe there is someone who gets into that role and starts going, oh, except for this one religion.
Yeah.
Except for that one.
With this thing I care about heaps.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. So, if you want to read that, Morgan Begg's media release is on the IPA website, ipa.org.au. And hopefully we'll be talking to Morgan either this week or, well, actually, last week of the show next week. So, we got actually something quite special for you. And we should have actually had an announcement at the start of the show, but maybe we'll tease that out for later in the show. Something for the listeners to look forward to. But, yeah, we'll talk to Morgan a bit more about this because there's a whole lot of interesting legal rights discussions to be had about all this and the role of free speech and how limited government. So, make sure you go into the IPA website, reading all of Morgan's great work on this one.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I've got another one here for you. So a while back, you guys might remember how Nike had that ad with Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah.
And it was like, believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything. That's their new slogan. They use Colin Kaepernick because he's out of the league in part due to his political beliefs and how vocal he is about them. And that's a guy who's purportedly sacrificed everything because of what he stood for.
So this is the guy that was kneeling for the US national anthems before NFL games.
Yes.
Most people would know that.
But. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So kneeling for the anthems became a huge figure. Now no team wants to touch him because there's so much attention. And, you know, maybe there are some owners who are like, you know what, I don't want someone who kneels for the anthem on my team. But either way, no longer an NFL quarterback, no longer on a team, even though he probably does have the skill to be on a roster.
Yeah, there is a little bit of discussion around that. Some people say he's not good enough, and some people say he's just good enough.
Well, like, there are just...
You know more than me.
So, yeah, so you've opened up a can of worms here, Pete. You've got me talking about sport. But anyway, so, like, there are 90 paid professional NFL quarterbacks. Like, you know, only 30 play, but, like, 60 are on the bench just hanging out. And, like, 22 of them are good. And Colin Kaepernick, for whatever it is, like, he was in a Super Bowl once. And the thing that, like, we're going to get into the story, but, like, very recently, the Washington Redskins lost their quarterback, Alex Smith. And Colin Kaepernick, at one point in his life, when he was going for the Super Bowl, came in for Alex Smith after he went down with a broken leg. So you just think, like, Colin Kaepernick knows how to run an offense that Alex Smith could play for. I'm getting boring here. But the point is, like, he probably could have been signed by the Redskins. But there's just so much
baggage
that comes with it. And then also you got Colin Kaepernick, like, why would he want to be a part of a team? He loses the Nike deal. He loses all of this other stuff.
Yeah.
If he joins a team.
So does he get paid more now than he does as an actual player?
Yes. So we're getting sidetracked here. The point is, Nike are cowards. So Nike, you know, believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything. Great message. And we all thought, you know, how much is Nike committed to that? Apparently not that much because, an article came out in Spiked about a interview with this Turkish NBA player, starting center for the New York Knicks, Enes Kanter. He's talked about, like, Enes Kanter, Turkish player, very critical of President Erdogan. It's to the point where he's banned from the country now, can't go home, and his father had to disown him to protect the family.
Yeah.
Enes Kanter wants a shoe deal with Nike. Nike says, you're too much baggage. We don't want to be a part of you.
Well, he hasn't got a shoe deal with anyone.
He hasn't got a shoe deal with anyone, including Nike. Like, Nike have specifically said, actually, because of your political beliefs, we can't have a shoe deal with you because they'll close all the stores of Nike in Turkey.
Right, yeah. So any shoe people that take him up will lose their whole thing in Turkey.
Yeah.
So this thing of, you know, what was the slogan again?
Believe in something even if it means sacrificing everything.
Not so much.
Yeah, unless you don't want to.
Yeah, not so much.
And believe in a few things even if it means sacrificing things that you are okay to sacrifice.
Yeah, and not 1% of our global market sales. So Colin Kaepernick, right, good on him, speaks his mind. I understand there's a bit of a cost to that, but he does so in a country that protects freedom of speech, the rule of law, stuff like that.
Yeah.
This guy speaking out with actual cost to him.
Yep.
You know, his family's in trouble.
He can't go back to Turkey.
And they don't want to know.
Yeah.
So I don't mind if sporting companies get political. Like, some people say that. They say, oh, you know, shoe companies shouldn't get political. I don't mind if they do. That's fine. But they're not walking the walk in this case.
Oh, shoe company, not walking the walk. Very, very clever, Pete. Very clever.
Thank you.
All right. Cool. Shall we talk Brexit?
Yes.
Or the latest with Theresa May?
Yeah. So just a quick one. You probably already know what happened. But obviously this week they had the leadership ballot in the Conservative Party in Britain. Theresa May held on with 200 votes to 117, so she managed to maintain the prime ministership and the leadership of the party. Now, a lot of people, most people are saying, be that as it may, her position is still terminal. She'll end up getting the sack eventually, or she'll end up falling on her sword at some point. But I did see today a few people saying, you know what, British Conservative MPs want a bit of job security. They might just keep her because they think they'll hold on to their seat.
Well, she's already said she won't lead the Conservative Party into the general election.
Okay.
And said the party would prefer to go into that election with another leader. But, like, I think it's like that one where, you know, they challenged Turnbull and Turnbull won, but it was just such a terrible one. Apparently, Lesh was telling us before the interview the other day that the Conservative Party can't challenge her for a year. Like, that's just a Conservative Party rule.
Yeah.
Seems a weird rule, but...
It is a weird rule.
Yeah. Also, what a trip it would be to have only 117 people have no confidence in you.
Yeah.
I would kill for that. That sounds amazing.
Well, it is like more than a third of people.
Hey, well, I'm batting a much higher average than that one at the moment. But anyway, it's not good for her, and it does put Britain's now, Theresa May's like in Europe talking to European leaders about what form Brexit's going to take.
Whatever it is, like, she talks about.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of those leaders are going to be like, yeah, but are you going to be here in like 6 months? Like, how far ahead can we think about this? Yeah, Brexit is in a weird place. There's got to be no deal.
Well, yeah. I mean...
Like, it would be a Christmas movie miracle for them to come out with a deal from this point.
Yeah.
It is so bad right now.
Because nothing's going to get through their parliament.
Nothing will get through the parliament. The European court won't allow anything. Like, how do they do that?
I love all these economists and people and analysts and stuff coming out and saying, you know, if it's a no deal, all these people are going to be unemployed.
Yeah.
The economy is going to be terrible. It's like, I reckon I've heard this before, actually.
Yeah, I reckon you said that. Like, for 2 years in a row.
500,000 people would be unemployed.
Yeah.
They improved their employment by 500,000 people. Okay.
And Britain would leave Europe. Like, they would geographically leave the entire area of Europe.
Would move.
Yeah. Remember that?
I don't actually.
No, it's just like everyone saying, like, Britain's going to leave Europe as if, like, you know, Britain would geographically, the island
take
would
off.
Migrate. Anyway, so that's it for stories at the start of the show. We've got a jam-packed show for you guys. So we're going to be talking to Lina Kavuka. That's going to be first. And then after that, we're going to be talking to Matthew Lesh. And you're also going to hear from a few more of our campus coordinators talking about themselves and like where they're at.
Those crazy kids.
Those crazy, crazy kids with their Fortnite and their iPods. I ran out of references.
Internet and the wheel. Stuff like that.
Their fire. You distracted me. So, yeah, going to be hearing from a few more. If you do want to get involved with Generation Liberty, if you are at a university campus, we're at a bunch of university campuses over the next year. We're going to be at all of them. So make sure you're getting involved with the Facebook page and make sure you're going to ipa.org.au and getting involved. And if you do know people at university who are looking for some sort of community like this, let them know about it too. But before we do, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. We're available on iTunes, Spotify, any podcast app that you use or that your friends and family use. Make sure you're getting the word out and telling people about the show. And if you are listening on iTunes, please leave us a 5-star review. You can also leave a comment for the show. It is the Christmas season, so give us that 5-star review in the spirit of giving. And this is where I would cut to Nina, but she's still on a walkout after last week's show. So go to ipa.org.
We're not going to get Saul to do it.
Well, Saul, do you want to do it? Where can people go to be a member? Pop quiz, videographer, not involved with our membership team at all. What can people do?
IPA.org.au.
No,
that's right.
So go over there. Membership start as low as $22. So make sure you're buying a membership. Great Christmas gift if you've got someone in your life who cares about liberty and freedom. For as low as $22, they can support it for a year. And if you do want to donate to our end of finance, oh no, end of year Christmas appeal, that is also available at ipa.org.au.
Saul was the DJ at the 75th for those who were there.
Yes.
Just in case you're trying to play Saul.
DJ Saul Knight. What are your contact details if people need a
pro-liberty
pro-liberty DJ at the next event?
SoundCloud, DJ Saul Knight.
DJ Saul Knight. You heard it here first. All right, we'll go to those interviews now.
I'm Liam Kiss, the campus coordinator for UNSW in New South Wales. My political hero is a niche one. It's Grover Cleveland, because he's actually a very underrated president who slashed tariffs, reduced tax, really was anti-regulation and very dry economics before it was cool. And to hear about more cool people like Grover Cleveland, get involved with Generation Liberty.
Okay, we're now going to speak with Linda Kavuka from the African Students for Liberty, all the way from Nairobi, Kenya. Linda, welcome to the program. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to be a supporter of the philosophy of liberty?
I had always been the kind of person interested in bringing about change in my society in one way or another. And that's one of the reasons why I chose to study law. And, you know, growing up in Kenya has a fairly stable political and economic environment. But we are surrounded by countries that have had decades of civil war, like Sudan, Congo, Somalia, Burundi. So growing up, you know, I saw all this in the news. We have one of the largest refugee camps called the Dadaab camp in the northern part of Kenya, you know, and watching conflict all around. And also we have a high level of high levels of youth unemployment in Africa. And I thought, you know, I should be a part of those people who bring change in one way or another. And at this level, I said, I'm among the fortunate who has been able to go to, you know, have a fairly good education. And I don't have money, but I think I can share my knowledge with, you know, fellow young people. And so these were the first steps that actually contributed to me joining this organization. I was seeing it as a platform of me being able to help other young people around Africa make better decisions and all that. So as I joined it and I started learning about the classical liberal ideas. So yeah, my friend gave me this book. It's called Politicians, Dependents, and the Bubble That Broke the World Economy, edited by Tom G. Palmer and, you know, supported by Atlas Network. So the book gave me a very interesting insight, you know, deeper understanding on basic economics. And like, it really opened up my mind and I was hungry for more. And these were the first steps of me beginning my journey into the libertarian movement. And then I formally joined Students for Liberty, where I got training on how to be an advocate for liberty. And yeah, the rest is history from there.
That's awesome. So we've talked about your journey to freedom, but is there much of a appetite, is the movement for liberty in Kenya and maybe Africa as a whole? Are there people that are calling out for more liberty?
Yes. So I would say the liberty movement is fairly new in Africa. And other than two major organizations in Southern Africa that are like began a long time ago, the Free Market Foundation, the Institute of Race Relations, both in Southern Africa, those are the oldest libertarian organizations we have in Africa. And one other person who had been speaking about free trade a very long time ago is Professor George Ayite from Ghana. Mm-hmm. So, and we had other two individuals, including June Arunga from Kenya and Franklin Cudjoe from Ghana also, who is now founder of Imani, one of the largest think tanks. As you can see, like, those were very few individuals who were speaking about maybe from the early 90s to early 2000s. So Students for Liberty formally launched in 2013, and we were reaching out to young people in campuses and recent graduates. So that's when we started really growing the numbers of the movement on our end, like targeting younger people. So what drew us, like having, you know, students in around five countries and those individuals that I had mentioned to you that were older and had been doing research and on free trade, today we have like students we have trained in African in Students for Liberty in 24 African countries. And we also have newer think tanks that have emerged that have been created by our alumni in like about 15 different organizations, including national NGOs, online TV stations, media platforms, and think tanks. So compared to like the developed world, the US, Europe, we still have a long way to go in terms of our influence and our size. But over the past 5 years, we have really grown significantly. And one of the impacts of like what we do and how we're able to contribute to change in Africa is recently in Southern Africa, just 2 weeks ago, the Free Market Foundation hosted a conference called Expropriation Without Compensation. So the South African government wants to make a change on the constitution to remove expropriation with compensation. That means like the government exercising its power of compulsory acquisition of land. It is currently with compensation that is just and equitable. They want to remove that, and like it will now be without compensation. So the Free Market Foundation invited us from different African countries, top libertarians, to go and speak about our experience from our different countries in Kenya, Burundi, Zimbabwe, Ghana, Nigeria, and other international organizations from India and Europe. And we were able to speak about how bad this policy is, what it will mean to the economy of Southern Africa, and, you know, telling them that they shouldn't have this kind of fund, and also, you know, speaking more about who we are and what we do. We are making strides in the right direction, I think. And I think we have done a good job considering how the African environment is. Africa, we have some of the most brutal dictators the world have ever seen and that are still ruling now. And most of African countries don't have freedom of expression. There are some African countries that are still experiencing civil war today. So we are limited in what we can or can't do around the continent. But the positive story is that we are actually teaching many people about these ideas who have now joined us, and we are making strides in the right direction of bringing a more free Africa.
So, Linda, you just talked about land rights in South Africa as a major issue. Is property rights a big issue for what you guys work on in the Liberty Movement in Africa? Is that one of the main things that you talk about?
Yes, land to many African societies is like land is central to African person's life. And what in the past was considered as land, obviously now in the modern world, is related to like property. So this is a very big issue, especially in countries where, you know, there's no ease of doing business and countries that are being run by dictators, in other countries that have a lot of corruption from governments, like property rights are not secure, in most African countries. So it's one of the issues we actually write about, speak about in our forum, and this touches to like the major topic we speak about is free market. Most of the African countries, I would say, and even African people, if you ask me, it's like our education system, our environment raises us to be pro-socialism. And that is a big problem for us. And you see countries after independence, the presidents were borrowing the Marxism kind of ideas, which were implemented into managing the countries. And some of these countries are the ones that have the most brutal dictators. So also that notion and brainwashing that we have gone through, like to believe that we are socialists and communism and Marxism and socialism is what we need, is one of the major issues that we are trying to tackle by teaching people about classical liberal ideas, teaching people the right, what capitalism should be and not what they think it is. Other topics we speak about are entrepreneurship, obviously tackling the huge percentage of youth unemployment that we have in Africa, and also trying to help some think tanks speak about the ease of doing business, which is opening up their markets, we speak about open borders, travel within Africa is very expensive. Funny thing is, it's sometimes cheaper to travel to Europe than within Africa because of the huge taxes we have, very restrictive laws, and very difficult visas to get. These are things that we shouldn't have, and that, you know, if we cure them and if we advocate for free market, free movement, open borders, we lead to prosperity of Africa. So these are some of the key things that we and the Liberty Movement speaks about heavily in forums. We write about, have books on them, and we share with people about in Africa.
That's really interesting, Linda. We mentioned earlier a piece you had in the UK Telegraph a few weeks ago or a couple of months ago, where you talked about a lot of things, but one of the things I was really struck by was you talked about the free trade, free economic culture that exists in Africa going back through the centuries and part of African culture going back a long time. That's not a story we hear very often about Africa. Could you please tell listeners just a little bit about that and what you meant by that?
Yeah, so the first time I actually interacted with this idea and thought about it harder and believe in it now is from an article that was written by our mentor and huge libertarian professor called Professor George Aiti from Ghana. So
yeah.
He wrote in an article on, it's called Why Socialism Failed in Africa, in May 2005, and this was published by the Foundation of Economic Education. So he speaks about African traditional setting and how it was. We have communities that were led by monarchs. We have communities that were led by council of elders, that they did not have a central head. But then, if you think about how do African people own property, most African communities value land as the center of life, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And or animals. So in African traditional setting, land or crop or animals, they're not owned by the state, the monarch, or the council of elders, but these are owned by families. And people get it. You can only get the land if you're within that family unit, if you have that surname, or if you're within a specific clan. So it's like clans are settled in different areas, and under the clans, they have the families. And in this way, you can relate it to the modern-day individual. The modern-day individual was the African family. The family in the African traditional setting is the smallest unit. This isn't a public institution. It's like a private setting. You cannot own the land of an ex-family, of my family, for example, if you're not from our family, if you don't have that surname, or maybe if you don't adopt you, that's like our own. We have our own private setting, and each clan or each family has their own way of what they do. The families determined, for example, the communities that farmed, determined what they will plant and where, and who will farm on what specific area of their owned property. And it's the same thing with keeping of cattle and goats and camels. And inheritance was only to the son who belongs to this family, like generation after generation. You did not see the monarch or the council of elders actually owning the whole land, dividing it among the people, deciding what exactly we plant and where. So unfortunately, because of misconception, people think that, and even African people will tell you, Africa is socialist, we are for communism, but we aren't. Another interesting thing was how different communities traded with each other. Different communities produced different things. Some were hunters and gatherers, some were farmers, some kept animals. You know, some were in the coastlines trading with people from India and Persia and China. How did these communities communicate, and how do they meet? So because of human nature, I need something, you have something, and barter trade came up. People, out of spontaneous order, traveled, and in the route that they traveled, came, we study about the world's trade routes, ancient trade routes, and from this trade route, the path where different communities would meet, they set up markets. And these markets grew into now the modern-day big cities that we know today. These trade markets and points of contact were not established by the monarch or the council of elders, but through spontaneous order, people needed to train. And it came up, they had the freedom to do that and choose. And they chose exactly where they wanted to do this. Nobody ruled it. Nobody went to determine how they're going to trade or not. They had the freedom to do this. So you see clearly a picture that African communities were actually pro-free markets, and they practiced free markets and free trade and movement, free movement within the whole continent. So it is wrong to say that Africa was socialist. So unfortunately, this is something we don't speak about. So people think like it's a new concept. But for us to understand where we're going, we have to look at the past. And the past is very clear. It's just that, unfortunately, it has been miscommunicated. And, you know, we have now forgotten our ways. And it's easy for us to buy a false impression. Yeah.
So speaking of misconceptions about Africa, I know when people talk about the development of Africa on an international stage, it's always the idea that foreign aid is going to be the thing that saves Africa. And as you've said, like, it's free markets are going to help. What has been the African experience with being on the receiving end of foreign aid for so long? Is it a force for good?
So African countries can be considered as some of the major aid receivers for decades. And unfortunately, the countries that receive the most amount of aid are not the most developed countries. Look at Somalia today. It's a failed state. And in the 90s, Somalia was one of the countries that was receiving so much aid. And African countries have been receiving aid since independence to date. But African countries are in the third world. We're not seeing African countries moving forward in terms of development and like economic growth, but they're actually receding. Because there is a clear channel of money that is accounted for, now corruption in Africa has grown to such a large extent that it's uncontrolled. Look at Nigeria, Kenya, other African countries. Corruption is actually now like a disease that cannot be controlled. And the more aid you give, the more you're enabling these corrupt government officials to export it to, like, swindle money and take it to Swiss accounts. When countries are giving aid to Africa, unfortunately, some of these donors are not looking at the realities on the ground to consider what exactly the people need. But the communication is at the level of heads of state, and that's that. So the aid isn't resonant with the realities on the ground. And honestly, if anyone wanted to help people in Africa, it would be one private institution organization coming to directly support maybe some community in the sense of, you know, giving them education, giving them opportunities. Africa needs more opportunities than aid. Africa is one of the richest continents in terms of natural resources. We have anything you can think of is in Africa. But Africa is one of the poorest nations. Why is this?
Well, Linda,
aid will not resolve that.
Sorry for interrupting there, Linda. It's been great speaking with you today. A lot of our listeners will be very optimistic about hearing all the positive developments in Africa at the moment. Of course, the African Continental Free Trade Area is also underway, which is another very positive development. So Linda Kavuka of African Students for Liberty, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was exciting speaking to you, and thank you for the opportunity.
Hello, my name is Kate Oskey and I'm a campus coordinator at Campion College Australia. The reason I joined Generation Liberty is because I believe that every human being has an intrinsic right to liberty. And please join Generation Liberty, sign up to our Facebook page to hear about more.
Okay, we now welcome back to the show one of our favourites, research fellow Matthew Lesh. Matthew, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so you are the author of the IPA's latest report coming out on Monday, the Free Speech on Campus Audit 2018. It's continuing our work in this area. We've been doing this for a while. So Lesh, what are the findings in this report?
So the Free Speech on Campus Audit 2018 is the third in our series of campus audits of this formal state of free speech. So what we've done is looked at over 190 university policies and previous actions. And we've come to an assessment that, unfortunately, as your listeners might be aware, Australia's universities don't really put free speech at the centre of their thinking. So 35 of Australia's 42 universities were given a red ranking for policies.
Which is bad.
Which is bad. That's very bad. Bad. Yeah, very red bad. Bad. Red
you want
bad.
Green. You want it's, green, so you do not want red.
It's a traffic light system. So red bad, amber okay, green good.
Yeah.
And so 35 of 42 received a red bad ranking for the policies and actions that are concerning. Six received an amber ranking for policies and actions that threaten free speech, and just one, our old favourite, the University of New England, received a green ranking for free speech.
And how is that the same? How did that differ from last year?
So it's a little bit of movement in the wrong direction from last year, in the sense that we've gone from 34 to 35 in a red ranking. There was some specific good news. There were a few specific policies that have been reformed. In fact, the University of Melbourne Vice Chancellor Glyn Davis, not the biggest fan of mine, but he did admit that he'd reformed his policies in response to a previous audit. But there was, at the same time, there were really a lot of...
It's real impact, isn't it?
That's real impact. Yeah. That's real impact, Pete. That's what we do here at the IPA. There were, on the other hand, though, there were a bunch of new policies that were concerning. For example, a good old friend at James Cook University have a policy that says you can't make someone feel offended in a single incident. So I hope no one's listening to your podcast up at James Cook University.
Yeah, we're done. We can never go back there.
What about all the stupid things you have to listen to in class?
Yeah.
And then, of course, what also screw you over would be the restrictions on sarcasm, which is just a fantastic idea.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a bit. You deal with a lot of academics and students alike when you put together these free speech on campus audits. Now, do you find that this censorious, like the anti-free speech measures, does that come more from academics and more from university professors who think so little of students, or are students asking for more protections?
I mean, often it's a bit of a mixture of both. So we've got cases where the students are the more censorious ones. So, for example, when Bettina Wright went to La Trobe University, initially the university tried to censor her, and then the university reversed their position. But the students and the student union, the people who used to call for free speech on campus, said that that somehow Bettina Wright was making their campus unsafe. Now, if anyone's ever met Bettina Wright, I can't conceptualize how anyone could find just her giving a speech to be unsafe. And we saw, of course, the same at the University of Sydney, where the riot squad was called. In other cases, there are issues with university administration, either sacking an academic, like in the case of Peter Ridd up at James Cook University, or not allowing certain speakers on campus, or the case of Victoria University where a film screening was cancelled. So it can be a bit of a mixture of both. And what I really think underlines this quite often is a cultural issue. So in this audit, particular audit, we speak to the policies. And I think the policies reflect something going on within the institutions where, and in themselves can then also restrict free speech. And I think the underlying cause here is this lack of kind of acceptance of those with different perspectives, this kind of, I guess, monoculture that exists in higher education. So when everyone thinks the same way, when everyone just happens to come from the same broad political perspective, those who might occasionally choose to express a different perspective are not just treated like them somebody who needs to be respond to in a logical, rational way, but they're kind of treated like heretics, going against the tribe that is the university culture. And when you threaten that tribal sense, people's ideas, they just don't know how to respond to it. So often the response to that can be censorious by nature and unaccepting of people with a different perspective.
So that's why I think the academics are potentially more censorious than the students, because the students are meant to be a cross-section of society, but the academics are clearly not. Yeah. And their politics is very censorious, and censoring in a lot of academics' politics is absolutely fine. Anyway, off track there. What are the worst?
It was good stuff. Yeah, I nodded.
I was just thinking about that. What are the worst universities and why are they so bad?
Let's name names. So, I mean, the University of Sydney has once again come up as the number one worst university in the audit in terms of our hostility score. So the University of Sydney...
By a fair margin.
...comes out quite badly just because of the number of incidences that happen on campus particularly. You've got, obviously, the riot squad being called because Bettina Wright decided she wanted to give a speech on the campus.
To ensure safety for women on campus, they threatened violence on a woman.
Perfect logical reasoning there. You've got the quite recent sacking of an academic by the name of Tim Anderson. Or should I say potential sacking of an academic by the name of Tim Anderson coming up. You've got previous instances in previous years, like the banning of the red pill screening by the student union, a quite aggressive protest against no campaigners that turned violent in the same-sex marriage campaign last year. So University of Sydney just has quite a history of concerning instances when it comes to free speech and people trying to censor speech. On top of that, another one that comes to mind, of course, would be the opposition to the Ramsey Centre. Although, of course, the university can say yes or no to the Ramsey Centre, what some of the opposition internally says is that, well, these are ideas that shouldn't be able to be explored at university. Western civilization is inherently misogynist or sexist or racist or whatever other claim you're gonna want to make rather than actually following reality. And as a consequence of that, they just want to censor people with different perspectives. So that it comes up quite badly in this audit.
Yeah, to give people a sense of how bad it is. So you make a like score which aggregates the number of problematic policies and actions. Australian National University 17, James Cook University 17. They're the second and third worst, I guess. And then University of Sydney 58. So more than three times worse.
There's
than the
lot
other
of things
ones.
Happening.
They've stuffed up.
What's that account of? Sorry,
scoring.
So that's.
if I can talk about Matthew Lesh's report for a second. No. Go ahead.
For it, James. Well then, welcome to. I'll let you do the PR on it. So it's that score is what we call on the audit the hostility score. So that's effectively a count of how many. Either concerning policies there are or concerning instances there were on the campus.
And three times worse.
And so it's three times worse than the second worst in terms of that count, yeah.
So we talked briefly earlier about some universities banning sarcasm. Now, I don't know how you go about doing this. Like, what is the idea behind... Like, how do you actually police sarcasm? Because... I often accuse Pete of sounding sarcastic when he's just sounding genuine. It's just his infliction, the way he speaks. So should Pete go to jail?
I mean, I think Pete is almost certainly bullying you, James.
Yeah.
As a regular
Pete should go to jail.
As a regular listener to this podcast.
I mean, probably should go to jail.
Yeah. Pete should go to jail.
Not for my interactions with you, but just for the way I conduct my affairs.
I will be a character witness for the prosecution. Anyway, so how do you ban sarcasm?
Well, I mean, and that's the golden question here. So the way these kind of sarcasm revisions come out in these policies and where it's often the best intentions turn bad is so universities have reflecting, I suppose, a coddling culture where they feel like they need to protect people from hurting each other's feelings, protect people from bullying and harassment. Of course, genuine bullying and genuine harassment shouldn't be acceptable on campus. You shouldn't go out of your way to make people threaten people's health and safety. But what they've done is they've designed these policies in such a broad way and defined bullying so broadly as the point where not only genuine debate, but comedy and banter between people could be covered by the policies. They've just been very badly designed. I think it's often that universities are applying some of the workplace relations principles of workplace relations bullying policies to the university campus and to students, even though, of course, students are not employees, so that there's no legal requirement for them to do so, and it's quite problematic when they do so. The most common thing you see on top of the sarcasm provisions is you see across a whole swathe of universities, like most universities will have some kind of prevention on offensive speech. And again, good intentions, no one should go out of their way to cause offense to others. That's not something that any civilized person would advocate for. But the problem and the slippery concept of causing offense is that something that I might be a genuine political point that I'm making, you might find quite offensive. You might find the idea that I'm disagreeing with you really confronting and offensive to your sensibilities. And then as a consequence of that, you'd have recourse under these policies. Something else these policies do, quite a lot of them, is not only do they talk about offensiveness, like 18C might about racial offensiveness. They even include, in terms of the characteristics in which you cannot offend people's political views. So if I say F the trots, that could be considered offensive politically, or F the liberals, or whatever else.
Thank you for keeping this family friendly. So, yep, well done.
F, who knows? And then the other one, of course, is that they put in there is they have a religious offensiveness test. So you can't offend someone on the basis of their religion. Now, we used to call those blasphemy laws. in
oh, we still do. Yeah. We still do. Yeah.
So if I decide that I want to criticize Christianity or Judaism or Islam as a set of ideas that like any other set of ideas should be in a free society, able to be criticized, I could be offending you on the basis of your religion and therefore contravening the university policy. And I think it just speaks to just how badly designed some of these policies are and how unthought out these policies are.
Yeah, Glyn Davis, former University of Melbourne Vice Chancellor, your old friend,
as you
described them before, and now at ANU, he had a massive go at your report at an ANU conference recently talking about the methodology. So write a reply.
So I was in fact also speaking at this summit, and this was Glyn Davis gave a kind of a keynote address to introduce the summit, which to be honest, I didn't know would be so extensively focused on me. I was kind of initially extremely frightened and shocked as I was sitting in the kind of the second row, and then kind of honored that he'd spent so much time analyzing me and reading all my work and trying to go through it. So what the key argument here, I guess, between Glyn Davis and I is about, I guess, the quant of the problem. So we're both not necessarily disagreeing about much of the evidence, although we might have different interpretations of particular events, but it's a question of whether or not the evidence reflects an underlying culture or whether the instances which people talk about are just kind of happen to happen and there's no link between them. So Glyn Davis's claim is that I've cherry-picked a bunch of data and to make these claims, even though he does describe the Free Speech on Campus audit as the most thorough work in the field, but he just doesn't quite think it's enough. Now, this might sound like, and I think it is a genuine criticism as someone who's interested in social science, you always have to assess the evidence and assess your reading thereof, the evidence and the quant thereof. I would say just broadly in response that he effectively the same criticism he is making of me, what he said we called special pleading, is very much what was happening in response. He chose to cherry pick out a few things, downplay them, and then say, well, there's no evidence of a crisis here. But more fundamentally, I don't think he responded whatsoever to the concerns about viewpoint diversity and just the lack thereof in academia. He just didn't seem to be interested in this idea that really over time universities have become dominated by a single line of thinking and that kind of impact, the kind of cultural impact that can have on the kind of allowable speech, which is then reflected in the actions the universities take or the policies that are designed thereafter. For example, there's universities that formally dedicate themselves to a social justice mission. Now, social justice might be a genuine viewpoint to have. You might say that there are issues with the power institutional dynamics in society, but it's not clear to me that the purpose of a university is to pursue social justice. The purpose of the university is to pursue intellectual freedom, debate in the pursuit of reason, truth, and progress. It's not to have a single ideological framework. And I don't think the universities have quite worked out how to respond to that particular assessment of them, other than to say, oh no, we people do think all different ways, but you know, the difference between a Foucauldian and a Trotskyist and a Marxist on the other hand, and then somebody who's more of a fan of Derrida over there, it doesn't...
It's a good sitcom though, to get all four of them in a house.
It's a great sitcom, but it doesn't mean that there's a true wider diversity of thought. And I think that's the real struggle that universities face, because it's not clear how they can fix this issue in the first place. And it's absolutely not clear that most of them are willing to acknowledge that it's a problem.
Well, I mean, it's not unsurprising that Glyn Davis focused on your work, because the IPA is a pretty, what's the word, sole trader in this issue, I think. Like, it's definitely an IPA issue, and it's got a huge amount of splash in the national discussion. So well done, Matthew. One more question. Censorship at universities might be getting worse, but you have been having a lot of interactions with academics and students. Do those interactions give you cause for optimism?
Look, on the one hand, Glyn Davis was critiquing me up on stage. On the other hand, though, a lot of the other people at this particular seminar up in Canberra were coming up to me and saying, oh, wasn't that nonsense what Glyn Davis just said? You know, I've seen exactly what you're talking about firsthand. And I think there were a lot of students out there and even a lot of academics out there who are very much trying to challenge the monocultural line of thinking and trying to push back against it. Sometimes there can be people who are sadly too frightened to speak up, but more often than not, there are students and there are academics pushing back against a monoculture and trying to say things otherwise. And I think that's really shown by the IPA's Generation Liberty program, which is just doing absolutely fantastic work on a dozen university campuses all over Australia, pushing back against the monoculture.
Very cool. All right, Matthew Lesh, research fellow here at the IPA. The report is Free Speech on Campus Audit 2018. If you do want to read it, go to ipa.org.au. And while we're plugging things, Democracy in a Divided Australia, Matthew's book, if you want to read that, it's selling very well.
Great, great Christmas present.
It is. Well. Christmas is coming up. So, Matthew, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, good. Matt.
Hi, my name's John Hedrick. I'm the campus coordinator at the University of Melbourne. I think I probably started to realise that I wanted to do something for freedom and work with the IPA, with their program, after about the end of my first year at the University of Melbourne. I started to see a huge gap in the market for that kind of thing and a need for it and a thirst and a hunger for it amongst university students.
All right, thank you to Matthew and Linda for those interviews and great hearing from those campus coordinators. So make sure you are going to the Generation Liberty Facebook page and also going to ipa.org.au if you want to get involved.
That was cool. I think we've only got one or two continents to go for interviews.
Mm.
Now that we've done Africa.
South America?
South America and...
Ooh.
Antarctica.
Antarctica.
Yeah. We've done every other continent.
Let's interview a penguin. Let's do it. Well, that time we heard them. Well, they're still there. All right. Cool. So let's get into some stories and matters of life this week, Pete. And I don't want to speak for you, but I'll speak for myself that this Vermont man was my favorite story of the week.
Yeah. Well, I say Vermont. The smart kids say Vermont, which I think is how you pronounce it. A state in America. There's a bloke called Ted Pelkey. We're going to try and get him on the podcast. That's a promise to you.
I'm going to try and get him installed as British Prime Minister. This is a man I want managing Brexit.
This bloke is leadership material. He's a fella in Vermont, America, who wanted to build a shed on his property. You wouldn't have thought that's too much of a difficulty, but it was. The local municipality put up barrier after barrier after barrier, and after 10 years, he's still working at them to try and get this shed up, right? So that's been proven to be impossible. What hasn't been proven to be impossible is Ted has erected a 700-pound wooden sculpture of the middle finger directed at the local municipality for not allowing him to build this garage on his property. Now, whilst they were able to deny him to build a garage, because the middle finger is public art, it is protected by the First Amendment. As I said yesterday, and how I thought I missed, God bless America.
God bless America indeed. So that's how you respond. Mm. You can't get a shed, you're getting a middle finger.
That's
like,
right.
Forever. That's Do you know it. My favorite part of this?
Don't know.
It lights up at night.
Does it? I didn't know that.
There is no rescue.
Like the Eiffel Tower.
There is no respite.
They can't move it.
The sun,
First Amendment.
Yeah, the moon cannot save you. Yeah. Right? You will be giving the middle finger to him.
My favorite bit is that it cost him $4,000. It's just like,
can you put a price tag on this?
Worth every cent, mate.
Can you put a price tag?
I would have paid $40,000.
He should do a GoFundMe.
Yeah, he should. Anyway, we're going to try and get him on. I don't know how we're going to contact him, but we'll try.
Yeah. I think we put up another beacon in response, which is a thumbs up, and then they'll meet in the night.
Yeah.
And then that'll happen.
Like the bat thing.
Like the bat signal. All right. I got another one here. This one won't be as funny.
That's
and
right.
They've tried their best to not be as funny. So the University of London.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about how much free speech is dead in London. Another one for you. University of London, they're having a comedy night. Big time. Big time laughs. For everyone involved.
Lols everywhere.
Lols everywhere.
It's meant to be a charity event as well.
It's a charity event. They have required all the comedians invited to perform for charity to sign a behavioural agreement that stipulated love, joy, and acceptance would be the themes of the performance.
Boo.
Absolutely. Yeah, like love, joy, and acceptance. Who goes to a comedy show for love, joy, and acceptance?
Who goes anywhere for those things?
Yeah,
I can't feel them, so no one else should.
You and me both. All right. By signing this contract, the agreement says, you are agreeing to our no tolerance policy with regards to racism, sexism, classism, ageism, ableism, homophobia, biphobia, transphobia, xenophobia, Islamophobia, or anti-religion, or anti-theism.
Anti-atheism. Atheism.
Maybe anti-atheism. I see it as anti-theism. But anyway, what does that leave?
Well.
Like, what can you make jokes about?
I don't know what all those things are, for a start. But if you can't make fun of religion and you can't make fun of atheists.
Yep. And you can't make fun of rich people, classism.
Then what do you do?
Jokes bet.
We need jokes. One of these, though. We need a behavioural agreement for. But the thing is, it's like the bar is so low.
Yeah.
Like if one person is offended, then that's, in modern society, that's the bar of not being acceptable.
Yeah.
Oh, everyone knows this. I don't know why I'm sort of researching it.
Well, no, but you still need to point out, like if one person in that room is offended by anything.
Yep.
the event's ruined for everyone.
That you can't say it?
Yeah. Comedy night.
It's too low a bar.
Comedy night.
And so comedians are saying they're not going to do it.
Yeah. That's, well, why would you? Why would you? That is the worst crowd ever.
Yeah.
Like, that. No one's looking to laugh. Everyone is looking to go viral on Twitter. They're just sitting there on their tweet going, I'm going to get offended by this next guy and ruin their lives.
Yep.
That's the whole thing. Why would you go play that?
He wants low taxes. What a pastor. We can't say that. He wants low taxes. What a bad guy.
Yep. One person they won't be inviting, Pete, is Titania McGrath. Oh, us? We wouldn't accept, but Titania McGrath. So,
Titania?
Titania, Titania, whichever way. Twitter account. You guys might know it if you are on Twitter, but it is a parody account of, they describe themselves as a radical intersectionalist poet committed to feminism, social justice, and armed peaceful protest. Parody Twitter account of, woke culture and all this sort of stuff. Very popular, and Twitter shut her down for a day because she banned guidelines, like user guidelines.
Yeah, vague. Ah, user guidelines. Yeah.
Like, again, we said it at the time that Alex Jones got kicked off Twitter. It does not end with Alex Jones.
No.
Like, there are going to be so many more people that are going to be banned from Twitter.
There's heaps of people.
Yeah.
And as we keep saying, they're a private company. They can get rid of who they want.
Yeah.
But they don't care about any kind of debate.
No. Yeah, you can have whatever opinion you want on Twitter as long as it's mine.
And she's she's humorous, right? Like, she's not...
it's not my... cup of tea. It's not my favorite Twitter account in the world, but is it yours? It's no Wint. Check out Wint, by the way. That's hilarious. Not my cup of tea, but it's a classic thing. Like, Twitter has just absolutely lost the plot.
Yeah. And then, so I was like, they sack him, and then they go, oh no, there's a backlash.
Yeah.
Reinstate one day later.
Well, yeah.
So how many people are not getting, their sack but not getting put back on?
Yeah, yeah. So how many, that's a good way of Twitter being both censorious and then cowards. They lasted a day of this brave protest against this fake account.
Yeah, I'd like it better if they went, nah, sorry,
nah, it's done. It's over. Yep. If you want to read more about it, the person behind the Titania McGrath account, and it might also be Godfrey Elfrick, the accounts are very similar. But anyway, she wrote an article in Quillette that came out today. One line here just to get a flavor of what she's about. So, the permanent suspension only lasted for a day, but the experience was traumatic and lasting. I now understand how Nelson Mandela felt.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping it in the stride.
That's the kind of stuff she got banned for.
Yeah. So, that's the thing that Twitter can't allow because of user guidelines. All right. Cool. Pete, let's go to another story.
Let's stay with the censorious theme. In the United States, a number of radio stations have taken off the air the famous song, Baby, It's Cold Outside. It's a Christmas carol type song. It's a secular Christmas carol. And they've taken off the air because of its sexually predatory nature. If you haven't heard the song, it's a bit of an old song. So
I reckon everyone has heard the song. I've heard the song, but most people would have heard the song.
I reckon 75%.
Right.
Or 90%. Of our millions of listeners. So that means...
Let's fight this out.
That means there's millions of people that haven't heard it. So... Anyway, it's about this guy trying to convince this girl to stay at his house. She wants to go home because it's getting late or whatever. And he's saying it's cold outside.
Yeah, yeah.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Sorry, Dad.
That's all I got. Sexually predators. That's predatory.
So it's one of those, I got to say, I listened to the song today just to refresh all my spirits about, refresh all my memory about it.
Yeah.
It's a little creepy. I'm not going to lie. It's a little creepy.
Yeah, baby.
You
can give it different reasons.
Yeah, yeah. It is a classic song. Yeah. Like, there are weird lyrics in classic songs anyway.
Yeah.
Like, when you really, sit down with Biggie Smalls lyrics for a little bit and come out with, view of what Biggie Smalls is about. But, it's just the culture at the moment. Like, anything old and kind of creepy, it's got to be purged from the radio.
I've got another one. I know this is not your biggest one, but Princeton a cappella group.
I hate this. I hate this story to the very pit of my soul.
So
can we just I'll explain a few things. Just on the Baby It's Cold Outside. So it's a song from the 40s. It's a duet, if you haven't heard it. It's a duet between a guy and a girl, as Pete says. But a lot of what she's saying is not that she doesn't want to stay, but what will the neighbors think? Or my mom's going to be scared. And so there is a way you can interpret the song, which is more about 1940s society or 1950s society of women's sexuality rather than a bloke cracking onto a girl that doesn't want to be there. And in the end, they do kiss.
There you go. But some feminists are no, this is a feminist anthem because eventually she agrees to stay.
Yeah.
The thing I think which annoys people is that she says, what's in this drink?
Yeah.
Which makes it sound a bit date rapey. But apparently in the 30s, that was slang for, I agree with you.
Well, yeah, so...
Apparently.
Yeah. It's a weird lyric. Like, that particular
one... That's
like,
the one that gets
I was
paid.
Like, whoa.
That's like, the one that gets paid. That apparently, like, in the 30s, that was...
Yeah,
like,
it's not as bad as they think, but, like, yeah, I guess times have changed.
If you were like, you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean. But anyway, tell me about this goddamn acapella.
Okay, so people will like this. The Little Mermaid, Kiss the Girl. Everyone knows that song. It's a singing crab, right? Telling this guy to kiss the mermaid.
Yep.
Princeton, a person wrote in the Princeton newspaper, a student newspaper, that it was misogynistic and dismissive of consent. Now, in the movie, she can't talk unless he kisses her. So she's like a mute, but I don't know if mute's the right word. But
you got it.
And she doesn't get her voice back because she gave... Anyway, long story. She doesn't get her voice back until he kisses her.
Yeah.
So the singing crab wants them to kiss, basically. And
Crab's just got to speak the truth right there. Just be like, look, here's the situation, dude.
Well, yeah, I don't know. That's a bit of a plot line. It's a plot hole, isn't it? I don't know why he doesn't do that.
I mean, it's a fun song, but if the crab is just like, look, dude, this might sound a little weird, but she actually can't speak until you kiss her.
How do you just explain it? It might have got around a whole lot of trouble.
It's like, I know I'm already a talking crab and your whole world is being shattered right now, but I'm about to make it even weirder for you.
Yeah.
But you got to believe me.
Nah.
Because I've got a fun voice.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, I'm interrupting.
Well, no, that's all right. But this as well has been said, it's misogynistic and dismissive of consent.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what? So you can't tell someone to kiss someone.
Yeah, so
ever.
what's Ariel supposed to do there? Like, she can't speak.
Yeah, so she can't give consent for a start.
Like,
so I had like,
big
so
old
thumbs
up. Like, build, she builds a statue that we were talking about before with the Vermont guy, and it's just a big thumbs up, but it's under the ocean.
Yeah,
but it does light up at night, so you can't see it.
Yeah, exactly.
The reason I hate this story, and, you know, like, we've had some fun with the talking crab part, but, like, so to bring it back, so this Princeton group, they were singing it at an acapella group. Like, they're an acapella group, they're singing it.
Yeah.
One journalist writes about how sexist it is, and they pull it from the repertoire.
Yeah, so they're not doing it anymore. That's the point I should have made at the start.
Pete, the day that I let a Princeton a cappella group affect my mood is the day I just give up.
Yeah, but...
Like, that is the most Ivy League hoity-toity thing I've ever heard in my life.
But these people
Princeton
end up,
a cappella group.
These people end up setting the narrative for the rest of the Western world.
You reckon the Princeton a cappella group's going to set the narrative for the rest of the world? You reckon the next president's in there somewhere?
Well, like, maybe.
Holding up the first tenor?
Oh, potentially.
Absolutely not.
I bet you if you Google... So the name of them is called Free Tones or Tiger Tones.
Oh.
Tiger Tone.
Get me a ticket.
I bet you there's someone from some president that used to sing in the Tiger Tones.
All right. Gentlemen's agreement.
Yeah,
right
Mars Bar. Mars Bar.
Mars Bar
thing.
Agreement.
Yeah.
I'm going to eat it on air again. I'm one for one.
No,
Mars
I
enjoyed
the last one.
What was... No, I've only ever won the Mars Bar agreement.
Yeah, so
okay,
I
another
it.
Mars Bar agreement.
Oh,
Who's
no,
won that, the Mars
oh, sorry,
Bar
I thought
agreement?
The eater... No, I got mixed up.
All right, cool.
Let's move on.
Let's move on indeed. All right, do we have any more?
Yeah, we've got Me Too God.
Yes, that's you.
Okay, so on this theme... Who is the latest figure in the crosshairs of the Me Too movement? The God Almighty. Now, I'm going to read you a tweet.
If you want to speak truth to power, no bigger power than the all-powerful God.
Don't get much more powerful than that, does it? This Minnesota professor called Eric Sprankle.
Whoa.
Who I think he calls himself Dr. Sprankle. Yeah, Dr. Sprankle. Tweets this out just before the holiday.
Sorry, is he a bad guy from like the Rocky Horror Picture Show sequel or something? Like Dr. Sprankle?
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Well, maybe. So he tweets this out 3rd of December, just before Christmas. Everyone's going on holiday. The Virgin Mary birth story is about an all-knowing, all-powerful deity impregnating a human teen. There is no definition of consent that would include that scenario. Happy holidays. So there's no definition of consent that includes an all-powerful deity.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. The amount of legislation they have in Australia or America, you would have thought all-powerful deity legislation would have been number one.
It just goes to show they don't read it. So... Now, this bloke called Tom Cleary, who's just some random, tweeted back and said, actually, LK1 2638, don't know what that means, states clearly that the angel...
I think that's Luke chapter 1. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway,
states clearly that the angel communicated God...
Here to help you.
Thanks, mate.
Lift you up.
Stated clearly that the angel communicated God's plan for Mary, and in verse 38, she agreed. Whether you believe or disbelieve, it helps if you actually read the text. Good point, Tom. Dr. Sprankle bites back. The biblical God regularly punished disobedience. The power difference, deity versus mortal, that is a big power difference, I'll give him that. And the potential for violence for saying no negates her yes. To put someone in this position is an unethical abuse of power at best and grossly predatory at worst.
Put down the Twitter account.
Eric, it's been a long year.
Yeah, just put down the phone. That's like whenever you're tweeting about that sort of stuff, just put down the phone, go for a walk.
Yeah.
That is what I would tell Dr. Sprankle.
Yeah.
Or Big Spranks, as I like to call him.
But... But this is the you know, yeah, those are the big issues facing people at the moment. If God got enough consent off Mary before.
Yeah, the other part of this story that I like, sorry to interrupt, but Big Spranks, he is not so much secular or atheist as he is a Satanist. Like, this is a guy, I'm reading from the same article. So, earlier in December, he tweeted a photo of a toy Christmas elf with his arm around a statue of what he appears to be a Baphomet, which I understand to be some sort of satanic symbol. An occult depiction of an entity regularly associated with Satanism. According to the Church of Satan's website, Sprankle also directed his decorated his Christmas tree with satanic decor.
Yep.
If you're going to Me Too God, your hero can't be Satan.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you have to choose.
Yeah.
You can't just say, look, God's a bad guy, but this Satan fella, he's where it's at.
Yeah, I mean, like, Satan's.
Yeah.
Got plenty of sins.
Yeah, he's the master of sin,
yeah, that's probably. That's his literal fallen job. Angel.
Yeah. So you got to rethink that, Big Spranks. All right. Yeah. Cool. So that's it for our show this week. I'll just run through a few other things that the IPA has been doing. So John Roskam, our executive director, he had an article in the Australian Financial Review today talking about Brexit and talking about what happens when politicians turn their back on voters, which is what's happening to Theresa May right now. We also have a lot of articles from the latest IPA review that have come out. So if you do like the IPA review, make sure you're reading those articles. And if you like those articles and you don't subscribe to the IPA review, they are only available with IPA membership. So make sure you're becoming a member if you want a subscription to that quarterly magazine, which is one of the best things we do here. So thank you guys so much for listening to this pod.
Sorry, just one more thing on the things IPA have done this week.
Okay.
Bella de Burra, Dr. Bella, was listed next to Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yep.
In the Spectator.
What was the title? Like, why were they listed next to each other?
They were just, their names were next to each other on the
front
cover.
Not just like, you know, best people with a first name starting with B.
They just had all the contributors.
Could even be alphabetical, like Bella been. And Benedict.
Anyway, she's had a big year because she got retweeted by Jordan Peterson and the Queen.
She got read by the Queen, retweeted by Jordan Peterson, and now is on equal footing with Benedict Cumberbatch.
That's it. That's what
I thought. He was a massive lefty.
Oh, I think he is, but he was in The Spectator for some reason.
All right, well, there we go. Cool. All right, so that is it for our show this week. Thank you to Linda and Matthew for those interviews and great hearing from the campus coordinators. If you like this podcast, thank you so much for listening and subscribing. Just make sure you're getting the word out to your friends and family. We're available on any podcast app that they want to listen to podcasts on. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you leave us that 5-star review. It really helps us out with the rankings, and that's great. Again, Saul, take two. Do you want to do the membership switch? Membership pitch? What am I doing?
I've never done the membership pitch before, but...
Where can people go to become IPA members?
Go to ipa.org.au.
Nina on the hot seat, yeah. To be honest. Nina is on the hot seat. So yeah, ipa.org.au, the membership starting as low as $22. Great Christmas gift if you want to buy something for the pro-liberty person in your life. And yeah, you get to become a member for a year. You get the IPA review. You get a lot of our publications and stuff. And you get to be part of Australia's loudest voice for liberty. All right.
You're going to tell me about next week.
Oh, yeah. So next week is going to be the last show of the year. So we've got something special cooking for you guys. We're going to be doing a year in reviews kind of show. I've been working away at all of our best podcast interviews. So we're going to be playing like highlights from them. If you do have a particular podcast interview that you really liked, make sure you're emailing me at jbolt@ipa.org.au. If you really liked any of these interviews or you wanted to hear more from one particular speaker or another.
Or less.
You know, we can cut out all the me and Pete stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's when the show was at its best. Yeah. It was when we weren't talking.
When other people were talking.
Make sure you're doing that. And then big announcement that I teased earlier in the show. So next year, the Young IPA podcast is going to be moving to Wednesdays instead of Fridays, which is going to be a lot of fun. That's all. Anything you want to reflect on in that announcement?
It's been a great year.
Cool. See you guys next week. Yeah, I cherish you, my love.